Stop being so aggressive.
It's the caffeine.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm waiting for a quorum before we gavel in because we have a little business we have to attend before we get to the field burning thing.
Can I do it right now?
I don't think it'll be very long, but I need 7 members here to do something first, and then we'll get rapidly into the field burning. I call the House Committee on Health Care to order. Roy, if you can hang in a bit, I'm going to open up this other hearing and get the first panel done while we're waiting for a quorum, and then I will close it. So I am going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2183, and I'm going to call the first panel to the table.
Thing.
That's Andy to the thing. That's Gail Shibley and Andy Ginsberg. And let me say, we have, as you can imagine, a lot of testimony. After this first two witnesses who are going to be giving us some background on the bill itself, I'm going to hold all testimony to 3 minutes, and we can get through as many people on the list as we can. We are going to close down at 5. So
okay, good.
If you all would introduce yourself and start the discussions.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenleck, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator with DEQ. And with me today is Gail Shibley, who's the Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health with the Department of Human Services. And we are here to provide information and support for House Bill 2183. This is a bill that was developed by DEQ at the request of the governor to address public health risks from exposure to field-burning smoke. Field burning, as I'm sure you'll hear today, is used after grass seed harvesting to dispose of leftover debris, also to reduce crop diseases and weeds and pests. But it has other benefits as well. It can reduce the need for the use of pesticides. It can reduce erosion from tilling, and it can improve crop yield. In 1979, up to 250,000 acres were allowed to be burned in Oregon, and then a phase down began in 1991, and that phase down went to 65,000 acres in the Willamette Valley. Excuse me, I meant in the Willamette Valley, and that number remains in effect today. We're going to focus our testimony on the health-related issues at the request of the chair. And
let me reiterate that request. Thank you, Ms. Berg. This is the Health Care Committee. This bill has a subsequent referral from here to the Agricultural Committee. I want to hold testimony today only on issues around the health effects of field burning, not on other matters like electricity failures in Corvallis or the agricultural implications of what we're doing. So let's hold it, and I will rule you out of order if we get very much beyond that.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Field burning and other forms of burning contain smoke from field burning and other forms of burning contain fine particulate carbon monoxide and a variety of toxic air pollutants. And these can contribute to or exacerbate a variety of heart and respiratory conditions. And the risk really depends on a number of things, the level of exposure, the duration of the exposure, and the frequency of the exposure. And it also depends on the age and the medical condition of the individual who is exposed. So before Gail describes the health risks, I want to really talk briefly about the exposure side of the equation, which is the part the DEQ is more expert in. And we look at three broad categories of exposure. The first two really are about routine exposure, and the third is about episodic or periodic exposure. So with the first two, I'll call them one long-term or annual average exposure. And this is really from the background levels of air pollution or particulate that is in the air in Oregon from a whole variety of sources over the course of a year. And then there's a more medium term of routine exposure, and we usually measure that in terms of the average daily exposure. And that would be from routine emissions that can build up when there is an air stagnation event. And the most typical example for us would be in some of our smaller community, rural mountain communities that experience inversions in the winter, and where there's a lot of industrial emissions and wood stove emissions that can build up. And so over the course of a day, you can have an increase in exposure. Right now, we have two areas of the state that actually violate federal air quality standards that were set to protect health for fine particulate. And we have a number of other areas that are at risk of going over the federal standard. So we're working on that very hard. But I want to emphasize that those problems are not really related to field burning. Those are from other types of routine sources of emissions, like, as I said, wood stoves or industrial emissions. Field burning tends to occur in a different season. We have our violations of the fine particulate standard occur in the winter. Field burning typically doesn't occur then. And also, during those inversions, the air is trapped, which means it's the local sources that are really contributing to it, and air pollution from outside typically isn't able to get into the area. So with field burning, we're really talking about the third type of exposure, which is a short-term and episodic exposure. Other examples that are similar would be wildfires or land clearing burning or just general types of open burning where you may be exposed once in a while, but the concentration could be quite high for a short period of time. So those types of emissions don't typically violate the standard. When you average it over a whole day, it's not that high, but for a few hours of the day, it can be very high. So any level of exposure can increase risk of health effects, even to an otherwise healthy individual. But in this case, we're most concerned about health risks to those who have pre-existing health conditions and the elderly and children who are more sensitive to a short-term high concentration and exposure. So with that, I'm going to pause and turn it over to Gail to describe what some of those health risks are.
Thank you. Andy, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services Public Health Division. You have my written testimony there. I don't need to reiterate the points that he has made in terms of field burning is no different from a health perspective, from any other type of burning in that, there are a variety of contaminants that are then therefore released in the air. Particulate matter, of course, is that contaminant that is of greatest health concern, which is a particulate matter is a composite of liquid and solid droplets that may contain other materials. It's not so much that it's the particle itself, but it's what everything that is attached to it, from chemicals, ash, dust, aerosols, plant debris, a variety of absorbed chemicals. And the finer the particulate matter, the more deeply it is inhaled into the lungs, and therefore the more adverse the potential results can be. My office recently completed a review of scientific literature that's published to really look at the health effects of particulate matter, a variety of exposure scenarios. We looked at not only, of course, agricultural burning, wildfires, residential wood stoves, urban air pollution, et cetera, and over and over and over again, despite the setting, it is a particulate matter that leads to both respiratory concerns, which is fairly commonsensical, but also cardial issues. The myocardial infarctions, for example, while we couldn't find anything that had a definite connection, that it raised several scientific eyebrows, I'll put it that way, that frankly was a concern to us. We certainly have received reports, and I think you may hear from others, health effects that have been communicated during or immediately after agricultural burning, including coughing, wheezing, asthma attacks, other decreases in pulmonary function. As many members know, I am a very strong advocate for children's health, and children, of course, not only breathe more air pound for pound than we adults do, but frankly, their human systems are simply not as formed and as finalized, if you will, as adults, and consequently, they are a population of particular concern to us from a public health standpoint. For different reasons, the elderly are likewise, and certainly those with compromised immune systems, as well as those also with existing body burden of disease, including asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We do collect data on the respiratory health of Oregonians, and Oregon's asthma prevalence among children and adults on the average is just over 1% higher than the average around the country. Within the state of Oregon, asthma prevalence among adults residing in Linn County and Lane County is higher than the statewide average. And while we are not trying to identify that, well, because those happen to be counties where there are also agricultural field burning practices, that's the result. I might suggest, again, from a health standpoint, that you turn the telescope around, so to speak, and say, how much more vulnerable are those populations to the exposures of this particulate matter in this kind of pulse exposure that Andy mentioned, than someone who is a healthy 70 kilogram adult male with no pulmonary or respiratory or cardiac issues. Therefore, we know that improvements in air quality are good for not only those populations, but for all of us in Oregon, and that improvements in air quality that may arise from this bill may likewise help to lessen the burden of asthma that is very seriously a debilitating disease and that is overrepresented in Oregon, as I said, than other parts of the country. Also, Mr. Chair and members, I wanted to share with you a report that's simply an internal working document, but I offer it to you for what the committee may find helpful. It was done by an MD, pediatrician, board certified in preventive medicine at OHSU that we had on contract, as well as a PhD toxicologist that we have on staff. And I asked them three very fundamental questions. One, what air contaminants are of greatest concern to human health? Two, what are the potential health effects associated with air contaminants released from field burning? And three, is there any evidence of health impacts to Oregonians from field burning? And as I point out, as this report points out, hospitalization data, while it is some of the best data when you can get it, is not particularly apt for discerning what in fact health effects may derive from field burning, because of this acute exposure that is field burning, very few people with asthma will end up in the hospital. They may take some very quick action, whether it's closing their doors, staying indoors, going somewhere else, literally to another airshed, so to speak, or going to the pharmacy and getting an inhaler, taking some pills, you know, doing some other things, but not going into checking themselves into the hospital is a rather extreme action, is I guess what I'm trying to articulate for you. And so while we do have those numbers, I would caution you to rely on those numbers to tell you, is this a problem or isn't this a problem? Nonetheless, I wanted to include them with you. I mentioned before that Oregon's population as a whole is particularly vulnerable to the possible effects of field burning because we are we do have asthma at rates that are greater than the national average. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn this back over to my good colleague.
And just to wrap up quickly, Mr. Chair, in the Willamette Valley, we have a smoke management program that's operated by the Oregon Department of Agriculture under a memorandum of understanding with the Oregon Environmental Quality Commission. And that program uses weather forecasting to control the time and the amount and the location of burning. And the goal is to minimize those times where the smoke might actually impact urban areas. And it's a very, very well-run program and successful most of the time. But there are times when the weather will change unexpectedly at the last minute after a burn decision is made, or where the burn is not well managed and there are smoke impacts in urban areas. And also, when the program is operating as intended and the smoke is directed away from urban areas, it does impact rural areas, perhaps at a lower concentration because it's a little further away, but you will have exposures in rural areas from agricultural burning. House Bill 2183, the governor has proposed this bill in response to his concern about the health effects from field burning. It would phase out field burning in the Willamette Valley by 2011. It authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to regulate field burnings in other counties throughout the state if that's necessary to meet the Federal Clean Air Act. And let me just note that last session we adopted a bill that allowed us to regulate agricultural emissions other than field burning if necessary to meet the federal law, but we neglected to cover field burning, and so this is intended to correct that oversight. It is possible under federal requirements that we will need to regulate field burning in other places.
It wasn't exactly an oversight.
Sorry?
I say it wasn't exactly an oversight.
Well, Mr. Chair, it kind of was, because the bill that we adopted dealt with our general exclusions, and we forgot that in this particular legislation there are specific requirements that had to be changed to conform with that. This bill, House Bill 2183, also, I should say it applies to open burning, propane flaming, and stackpile burning of grass seed fields, and it does not apply to habitat restoration burning that is conducted by land managers. It allows the Environmental Quality Commission to permit emergency burning, and that would be allowed in certain cases to prevent erosion. If you had, for example, steep terrain, and without burning, you would have to till a steep terrain, and that could cause erosion. It could allow emergency burning to prevent an outbreak of disease or an infestation of insects or other pests that could only be treated by fire. But the commission would have to do an evaluation and ensure that the benefits from the emergency burning would outweigh the public health risk from that burning. It increases the fees for field burning. The fees are intended to cover the cost of the program, and as we phase down the number of acres, the per acre fee needs to increase to cover the cost of the program until field burning is phased out. And then it also authorizes DEQ to look at other smoke management programs, not field burning, but smoke management in other in other areas, for example, rangeland burning or other types of burning, like land clearing burning, to make sure that those programs are coordinating well, that we don't have one program authorizing burning at the same time as another and potentially have two impacts at the same time, or that there aren't any gaps in that authority. So with that, thank you for allowing us to present the governor's legislation. I'd like to note the governor sees this bill as a starting point for a thorough discussion about the best way to phase out the practice of field burning, and he's happy to work with you on the details of the legislation. And Gail and I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
All right, why don't you hold in a minute? I've got a committee here. Roy, will you join us? I'm going to... do I have to close the public hearing? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2183, and I will open a work session and possible reconsideration of Senate Bill 155. As you all remember, we passed this bill last week, and it turned out there's a little glitch in it, so I think we need a motion for reconsideration, then we'll hear why we need to do it.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on SB 155.
Is there any objection to suspending the rules to reconsider? No. Tell us why we're reconsidering it.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for your willingness to reconsider Senate Bill 155, and apologies to the audience here in the hearing room for this intercession. I mentioned last week to those of you who were in attendance at the committee meeting that Senate Bill 155 merely increased the pool of potential candidates that we could consider for the hiring of the chief medical officer position at the state hospital. The current...
Wait a moment. Somebody's got a BlackBerry or something going. Could you please shut all those things off? Please up the recording system. That's what you're hearing. Somebody being called. Thank you. Go ahead.
I won't take the committee's time to talk about how difficult it is to recruit healthcare positions these days, but merely increasing the pool of potentially qualified candidates for the chief medical officer position that we've had vacant for or filled.
Just tell us what's changed in the amendment.
Yeah, it simply extends the opportunity to supervising psychiatrists at the hospital.
Okay.
And that was an oversight in the original language. The Attorney General's office caught and suggested new language. So in addition to the chief medical officer, we would have the ability to fill supervising psychiatrist roles with a contracted position as well.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Representative Harker, do you have another motion?
Indeed I do, Mr. Chair. I move that we reconsider the vote by which we sent Senate Bill 155 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be placed on the consent calendar.
Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay. Hearing none, the motion carries, and the measure is once again before us in the committee.
We didn't take a vote on the motion to suspend the rules.
We didn't take a vote. We heard no objection.
Let's take a vote.
Gavel.
We okay?
So there is no objection.
Good.
To the
now the motion is before us again, and I will ask for a vote on approving the motion, moving the bill forward with a due pass recommendation.
No, to be no. Placed
I need
on
another
the
motion,
consent
huh?
calendar. How about I repeat that motion?
This is amateur night, in case you haven't noticed. We don't have any adult supervision here.
Mr. Chair, again, I move that we reconsider the vote by which we sent Senate Bill 155 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and instead that it be placed on the consent calendar.
I thought you did that.
Yeah, we did
do
that.
But we can vote on it yet.
It doesn't make any difference.
There was no objection.
There was no objection.
Now,
no.
Okay.
Well,
we have to amend that.
We need a motion to adopt it.
Okay. And then we'll pass the bill again.
Yeah. And then we'll take a motion. Yep.
Mr. Vice Chair, we need a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 155.
To me, but I would gladly,
please,
Chair,
or anybody else,
move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 155.
Okay. Any discussion? Can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dimbro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Excused.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Aye. Dash ones are adopted in Senate Bill 155. Can I have another motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 155 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, sir.
By the dash ones. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dimbro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Excused.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that we place Senate Bill 155 as amended on the consent calendar.
There's a motion to move 155 to the floor on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So moved. Close the work session on Senate Bill 155.
Thank you.
Thank you. And are there any questions for the first two witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
We usually do it better than this. Yes, sir.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for the testimony. My question is, the health care consequence, I mean, I appreciate the fact that the chair's pointed out that we're here to talk about the health effects, not the agricultural effects or necessarily economic effects. In that line, what are the health consequences or effects by actually implementing this? And I guess what I'm getting at is if we get rid of field burning, what we're necessarily going to get based on the testimony is more pesticide use, more herbicide use, and I'm going to guess more exhaust from equipment to deal with thatch and other issues like that. I realize those have varying degrees of health effects. They may be concentrated, they may be broad, but it's not. I just want to make sure we're not talking about it in a vacuum. We don't get rid of one and everything else stays equal. We get rid of one and we get more of something else. And I guess I'm asking: is there a net negative effect? I mean, what wins at the end of the day? What's less harmful or more healthful?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, we don't have great data about the amount of pesticides that are used in agricultural operations or in field burning in particular. From what I've heard, because field burning is used to sanitize, that is, eliminate weeds, for example, and some of the crops that are currently grown in Oregon are sold into high purity markets, that it's possible that we may see more use of pesticides to reduce weeds, for example. We don't really have any data to support that. We don't know how much that would occur or whether there are other alternatives, for example, switching to other markets, switching to other types of crops, or using other agricultural practices besides the increased use of pesticides. We acknowledge that it's possible we could have increased use of pesticides, but we don't know to what extent that might occur. And then offsetting that is the exposure part of the equation again. Increased use of pesticides means that you have them applied to the land. Some portion of that may end up in the water, and hopefully not very much. If practices are good, it's kept out of the water, and it will stay on the land where it was applied. If it gets in the water, it may be taken up by fish, and there may be some human exposure, as compared to air emissions, which can be a very direct exposure, and so we have a much higher likelihood of human exposure to the risk from air contamination. That's not to minimize the concerns about water pollution. But just to try and get at your question, without perfect data to say, I think the exposures are more likely through air emissions, and I think management practices are possible to prevent much, if any, exposure to increased use of pesticides.
And I just want to make sure. Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I wanted to thank you for being such a great public health advocate. That's exactly the kind of paradigm that we constantly grapple with. As some folks have expressed it, there is a risk.
Representative Bruin has proven what a great public health advocate he is in the past session. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm quite sincere in that. There is a risk to getting
thank
up.
Somebody needs to be.
Yeah, he's great.
There's a risk to getting up to getting out of bed in the morning.
I just noticed.
There is a risk to not getting out of bed in the morning. And so consequently, we always have to weigh a specific action versus, you know, a range of alternatives, including not doing, you know, that at all. I do want to draw your attention to the penultimate paragraph in my testimony where I note just that unintended consequences issue. This is similar to the testimony that Public Health provided last legislative session on the issue about field burning, recognizing that from, you know, a human health standpoint, we can draw lots of different kinds of scenarios. And as Mr. Ginsburg pointed out, what we have to deal with data and what are the data that we have. I think he's articulated it as well as can be articulated at this point, given the ubiquitous nature of an air pollutant versus potential pathway of a water pollutant. I'm not in support of contaminated water, but I'm looking at the whole at recognizing that perhaps mass air pollution is an issue that is very non-discriminatory and very much more likely to expose vulnerable populations.
Mr. Chair, if I could add one more thing, and we may hear more about this from others that testify later, but we did include specifically in this bill the provision for emergency burning, and partly to address the specific concern. A scenario that I've envisioned, I don't know if this will happen or not, but is if we eliminate fuel burning in the Willamette Valley, after a number of years, it's possible that we could have, for example, a disease, let's say a fungus, that builds up in some fields that would require increasing amounts of pesticides to be used to control it, whereas a single burn or burning in one season to eliminate it could get it back under control. And so we have a, I guess you could say, safety valve built in case that type of scenario occurs where the commission can make that decision that, yes, in this case, the public health benefit of burning outweighs the public health benefit that comes from burning and avoiding the use of pesticides to control this outbreak outweighs the public health impacts from the smoke one time.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, Gail, whoever can best answer this, maybe you covered this, but I've heard that the propane flaming technique produces, because of its intense heat, creates a lower level of particulates than other techniques. Could you address that claim?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. I can address it to a degree. Propane flaming was developed as a lower emission alternative to open field burning. And at one time, in fact, when the current legislation was adopted, the existing statutes were adopted, there were great hopes that propane flaming would replace much of the open field burning with less emissions. It hasn't turned out that way. It's not used very much, and it probably has to do with the cost and also, you know, other operational factors. It is used some, but my understanding is that when it can be used, it's a good alternative, but it hasn't really played out in the market as a you know, large-scale viable substitute for open fuel burning. And probably some of the industry folks who will come up in a later panel can answer that better.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both very much. I'm sorry.
One question.
Yes, Representative Thompson.
Are you familiar, excuse me, I'm losing my voice today, and some people think that's good. Are you familiar with the laboratory and environmental assessment report from DEQ on air monitoring?
Not every line of
I'm not thinking that you necessarily would be. I know your department puts out a lot of reports. I'm looking at this. This is 2007 data, and I haven't seen 2008 yet, but you seem to indicate that Lane and Linn counties were areas of particular concern. Yet when I look at the May through October graph for the air quality indices, it's particularly low. And that's the broad season for field burning. When I look at the areas beyond those, it's quite high. And that's the area, I presume, is forest slash burning. And when I go to Lane County and look at Eugene Springfield, you have exactly the same thing. Now, if we're burning 6-8 days a summer for field burning, I would expect there'd be some pretty severe spikes within this zone. I don't see them.
Would you like us to get you a copy of that?
No, that's okay. I can answer it.
You comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, that gets to what I was talking about earlier in my testimony about exposure. Typically, we see higher concentrations of particulate in Oregon in the winter because of air stagnation conditions. We get a buildup of air pollutants that occur throughout the day over a multiple day period. When there's air stagnations, when there's inversions and air gets trapped and built up, our monitoring system is deployed to specifically to track those types of events. So where we have our monitors are in places that are likely to see concentrations build up when they're, in fact, we're required by federal law to site our monitors at those places that our surveys identify as the likely highest concentration spots. We don't have enough funding to monitor everywhere, so we monitor where we think it's going to build up. And those are areas that are affected by routine emissions, like wood stoves in the wintertime, for example, that build up over the day and concentrate when the air is trapped. You will see, we do have some monitoring for visibility and other types of monitors that are deployed in other areas that can catch those short-term spikes that occur from whether it's a wildfire or a field burn or something else. But those are deployed in a specific location, and if the Department of Agriculture is successful, as they usually are, the smoke is directed away from any urban area, and so we wouldn't see a spike. We may see a spike in our monitors that are in some of the rural areas to see where the smoke is going, but it's going to be a little bit suppressed from being further away. So what you're seeing in those charts is really the results of the strategy for monitoring, which is really to look for violations of the federal daily standard, and those tend to be wintertime events.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. But it's still, the graph shows for Albany, for instance, you're way down in the bottom of good. I'm having a hard time understanding where the amount of field burning we're doing these days is having any effect if DEQ charts are showing these kinds of numbers. And Albany is surrounded by grass fields. Surely some of it's going to get into Albany if it were a problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, again, that's our concern is, as Gail described it, is really with those sensitive people who, even if they're only occasionally exposed to a high concentration, even if only lasts for an hour or a couple of hours, could experience health effects. I should point out that even for otherwise healthy individuals, even a single exposure to fine particulate does have an causes an increase in your risk of health effects, but it's a very small increase as compared to your overall exposure. You wouldn't really see it in hospital admissions data or any other type of data like that. So I don't want to imply that, individual exposure to a short-term fine particulate is not a concern at all for healthy individuals, but for the sensitive population, it can be life-threatening. If you have asthma, for example, and you're exposed to a high concentration, even only for 15 minutes, it could be life-threatening. And so that's what we're weighing here. We won't see it show up in large numbers of people in the hospital. We won't see it show up on our monitor showing, a whole season of high levels or even lots of spikes. But we know that some exposed sensitive individuals are going to have health effects, and basically the trade-offs that Gail mentioned are the things that you as a committee need to grapple with of comparing those risks.
I don't know, there's something that's not quite right here. I mean, I am asthmatic, you know, and I have a couple of things I don't do. I don't go stand on the margin of a burning field, which I can normally see 300, 400 feet away at least. I don't stand in front of freight trains. I mean, but it, there are some personal choices here involved, and I'm having a hard time seeing where we have a health concern big enough to shut down the rest of field burning when we don't have any data. I mean, certainly, I mean, all kinds of things we do in business and industry may have risks attached to them, but if we get rid of every risk we have in our economy, we won't have an economy.
So how did you learn not to stand in front of a freight train?
I've observed others who did it.
We don't have any legislation out
there. Didn't work for them. It didn't work for them. I'm assuming it won't work for me.
Well, there may be some of this in this discussion, actually. Are there any other questions? Thank you both very much. I'm going to call, we have some testimony to be read into the record, please.
We have two letters, both of them dated March 11th, 2009, one from James K. Lace, Dr. James K. Lace from the American Medical Association, and there's a letter from Dr. Bob Zyback from Northwest Maps Company.
I think if we can get a fourth chair up there, I think I'll be calling four-person panel, so it would be helpful if we could. And would somebody ask Representative Holby to join us? He's chairing a committee.
Whoops.
Is he here? There he is. Yay. Johnny on the spot. Let's have Representative Holby, Dan Galpern, Damian Jorgensen, and Holly Higgins, please. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon to you and the committee. I thought I am supposed to be chairing a committee, but somebody else is taking care of that for me briefly.
I'll bet they're doing a better job than I've been doing so far.
I won't comment on that.
Doesn't need comment.
Thank you for allowing me to testify on House Bill 2183. I appreciate Governor Kulongoski bringing this bill forward. I also appreciate that the governor and the state agencies recognize that the burning of grass seed residue presents a public health threat that warrants the end of the practice. I am supporting House Bill 2183, but I would hope that the committee might consider some amendments that would more immediately protect the public's health, remove some of the fiscal impacts in the bill, and effectively achieve the goals of air quality statutes. You know, it just occurs to me that, you know, if the bill is its goal is to protect the public's health, and that is an important thing to consider. That public health is at risk today, just not 3 years from now. So I've provided some packets, and I'm not going to read. I've also provided written testimony that I'm not going to read to you because I know you can all read that. But I did want to kind of go through a couple of pieces in those packets. You know, we can look at charts of air pollution, and as Representative Thompson has, and those charts are really, you know, relative to what they're measuring. Are they measuring coarse particulates, fine particulates? So what kind of air pollution are they monitoring, and where are they being monitored from? Our monitoring stations are very site-specific, and they also graph things in averages, usually annual averages and 24-hour averages. One of the big issues with field burning is they're very short-term, intense concentration levels that are very site-specific. And I say that because it's important to know that when we look at measurements to make these decisions, you got to understand what we're measuring and, more to the point, what we're not measuring. So I just wanted to point that out, because we can have statistics that we've all heard for years and years that field burning produces 2% of the particulate air pollution in the state or in the Willamette Valley. And that being an annual average and the methodology for achieving that figure throws out some of the more intense burn days and whatnot. But I urge you to look at the chart, because in looking at statistics, you can also look at what we are measuring and what the real health impacts of fine particulates are specifically. The coarse particulates are something your lungs can deal with. And there's others that will speak to the medical impacts, I'm sure, better than I. But it's the fine particulates that your body has no defense from. You breathe them in, they go into your bloodstream. And those fine particulates recombine in the atmosphere with the toxic compounds that are also sent into the air as well. And so I've got a couple of charts in there, one of them showing that field burning produces over 40% of the fine particulates during the field burning season. And in relationship, motor vehicles and equipment produce 6%. During the four biggest burn days, they produce 63.6% of the fine particulates in the Willamette Valley. So these are very huge emissions that occur in a short period of time, and smoke management does a pretty good job of directing them away from urban areas, but smoke management is not really an exact science, and I quote John Beyer from the Department of Agriculture on that. In a two-hour period, winds can change, these plumes can create their own wind patterns, and we do have episodes where these smoke plumes go into neighborhoods or go into small communities that are more in the rural areas around the urban populations where our nepelometers are that impact those smaller communities, and we don't really measure that impact. So I just wanted to point out that some of those charts in there and the percentages and those sorts of things are very important to consider, because the field burning episodes are short term, they're very concentrated, we don't really measure them accurately, and they have really dire health impacts to people. Since introducing this bill in 2007, I've heard from thousands of people and organizations, and some of those that are supporting eliminating the practice of field burning are the Lane County Medical Society, the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Nurses Association, Peace Health, the American Lung Association of Oregon, Oregon Lung Specialist, a pulmonology group, the Lane Regional Air Pollution Agency, the City of Eugene, and the Lane County Board of Commissioners, just for a few organizations, and certainly hundreds, if not thousands, of people. There's clear and convincing evidence, medical evidence, some of which you'll find in this pack, in my packet, and probably others as well, that the short-term exposure of fine particulates and smoke have significant adverse human health effects. The smoke also contains, you'll see a chart in there of many of the toxic compounds that are contained in the smoke as well. And I guess it's just important to know that the burning of grass seed fields and cereal crops is particularly intense compared to other vegetation that's burned. I appreciate some of the questions that have come up. And Representative Bruin asked a question about, you know, the impacts of the pesticides that will be used to replace the burning. And, you know, I think what Mr. Ginsburg stated from the DEQ, because I've asked for those statistics as well, is as to how much pesticides are used on fields that are burned versus fields that aren't burned. And that data has never been produced and never been presented to us, and nobody will come forward with that data. So it's unclear to me whether they actually use. I imagine they do use. From some I've been told, some farmers actually do use pesticides on fields that they do burn. And the other part of that is to put that into perspective, is that 90% of the fields are not burned every year. We burn about 10% of them. And so that incremental increase in pesticide use on those fields that may choose to use pesticides, I think is pretty marginal. If, in fact, that increase in pesticide use is going to be a huge concern, then it should be a concern of the whole industry. And so I think that's something we need to consider as well. I appreciate the time that you've given me to lay this out. I want to point out that in my packet as well, I have three documented cases of death directly related to people being exposed to field burning smoke. One of them in a court affidavit, another one a death certificate, and another one an affidavit from a doctor testifying in Idaho. And clearly, the result of that is something that we have to recognize. You know, a field burning smoke in the state of Washington or in the Idaho is virtually the same as the smoke we experience here. Here in the Willamette Valley, it's complicated by some of our geography and the meteorological conditions of our valley that really tend to exacerbate this problem in the Willamette Valley especially. So I appreciate you looking through this information. I appreciate your consideration of this. I think the information, the data on the adverse health impacts of field burning are available. They're known to us. And, I think the state of Oregon, it's really incumbent upon them to move forward and in the practice of field burning, except in the cases, as Mr. Ginsburg has stated, when we have disease or outbreak or some of those exemptions that they have to weigh and look at specifically. I think it's time to end this practice. The costs to the public's health, I think, are outweighing the benefits that the state receives from the practice of field burning. And there are studies that also will give you that sort of indication that are also referenced in my testimony as well and is in others. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Representative Holby?
Thank you very much, Paul.
We have 18 more witnesses on the list right now, so I'm going to try and hold testimony to 3 minutes from now on. If you'll try and observe that, I'd really appreciate it.
And I will excuse myself, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
Hi. My name is Damon Jorgensen. I just want to say thank you for letting me talk about this issue. I'm a family physician in Staten, Oregon. If you look in your packet, Staten, Oregon is located 12 to 14 miles east of Salem, dead in the middle of one of the largest areas where you see most of the field burning occurring. And just to give you a little background on myself, I grew up in a rural area of North Dakota, in the heart of farmland, working on my grandfather's grain elevators, shoveling grain, while I was in high school, then subsequently moved to Oregon, went to medical school, and then performed a residency program out in Wisconsin. And I practiced there for a couple of years before moving to state, and I was looking for a rural area to take care of patients. And I moved here after the burn season in October of 2007. So my first exposure to the incredible burning that I've seen was in 2008. And it was detrimental to my patients. And I'm going to read from a statement that I wrote. My name is Damon Jorgensen. I live in Staten, Oregon with my wife and two young children. I work as a family physician caring for a broad range of patients from infants to geriatric patients alike. As a family doctor, the most common clinic visit I see is for respiratory illness. And one of the most devastating triggers for respiratory illness is smoke exposure. One example, which has already been touched on today, is asthma, an illness that tends to be more common in children and is easily triggered by inhaled pollutants. The essential abnormality of asthma is increased reactivity of the airways to stimuli such as allergens, viruses, and pollutants. Asthmatics typically have an early and a late response when they are exposed to such pollutants, with an onset of airway narrowing within 10 to 15 minutes following an exposure. They can have improvement within 60 minutes, when this can then variably, depending on the patient, be followed by a later response occurring 4 to 8 hours later. These events trigger the pathologic features of asthma, which causes airway inflammation, airway hyperresponsiveness, hypersecretion of mucus, and plugging of the airways, and airway obstruction. These repeated events result in chronic changes resulting in abnormal airway architecture and function, and this, as it proceeds, goes on throughout the person's lifetime, getting worse and worse. And we see something similar to this in other patients with COPD. Now, asthma is the most common chronic pulmonary disease, and it is actually on the rise in this country. And despite greater availability of effective pharmacologic treatment, studies are showing a trend toward an increase in mortality rates. Yes, you do die from asthma. One explanation is the increasing exposure to air pollutants, and we're seeing that rising in this country as well. Now, in medicine, we work tirelessly to encourage patients, persuade them to avoid that train, not step out in front of the train, such as with irritants that include cigarette smoking.
And with the help, can you wrap it up,
please? Sure. And with the help of legislators, it's made it much easier for me to do my job. And what I'm asking for is you people can do much more than I can to help my patients, because I can only see them one at a time in the office for 15 minutes, but I know that you can protect them with what you do by ending field burning. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members, Dan Galpern, co-director of the Campaign to End Field Burning of the Western Environmental Law Center. As Representative Hulvey noted, the campaign supported and endorsed by the medical community throughout the Willamette Valley and the state. We support an immediate end to field burning to protect public health, and we urge amendments to that effect. Last week, we released a study of field burning and air quality in the Willamette Valley based on state air monitoring and field burning data. The study summarized the relevant published medical literature, much of which is on our website, including an annotated summary, in which it is overwhelmingly established that fine particulate pollution is a significant threat to public health. Even small increases in PM2.5 increase cardiopulmonary events, increase the risk of death due to lung cancer, increase the risk of stroke. The good news, on the other hand, is that reductions in fine particulate pollution have been shown to increase life expectancy. From the data analyzed in our report, it's clear that those communities in the Willamette Valley with air quality monitors have been hammered at least 900 times over the last decade with sharp increases in fine particulate pollution at levels of medical concern. And it's also clear that because air monitors are few and far between, those estimates are exceptionally conservative. Indeed, we find that over 94% of burns are located further than 5 miles from the air monitoring stations, while more than 60 communities, listed in Appendix 2 in the report, which is in your packet, were within 5 miles of fields burned last year alone. These, then, are the sacrifice zones, cities and towns, housing residents, hospitals, schools and places of worship that are located near fields that are burned without warning and without monitoring of impacts. Now, the numbers, of course, only tell part of the story. They do not tell about grandparents whose asthmatic wheezing is exacerbated by field-burning smoke, the mother who is forced to shut her children inside on an otherwise perfect August afternoon, or the father who is enraged that his vulnerable infant daughter has been exposed to this potentially lethal and avoidable pollution. That father, I might say, is myself. The relevant state agencies, Oregon Department of Agriculture, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Human Services, have jointly determined that fine particulates in field-burning smoke can be inhaled deep into the lungs and that such smoke contains carcinogenic compounds that can reduce lung function and even lead to premature death. Our study reinforces that knowledge. Continued field burning is simply unacceptable. It should have been ended long ago. In our view, the bill before you is a significant step in the right direction, but amendments along the lines that Representative Hovey has suggested to this committee are necessary to provide immediate and effective protection, especially to the most vulnerable sectors among us. By this action, in conclusion, you can save lives this session without spending an additional dime of state funds. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mic.
Should have let you in first, so you didn't have to move. We'll take any questions after the panel.
Chairman Grelick, members of the committee, I want to thank you so much. I had an opportunity to be here a couple years ago, and it was probably one of the most important 3 minutes of my life. I live in what Paul Hovey calls a sacrifice zone. I live in Harrisburg.
Could you please identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Holly Higgins, and I live in Harrisburg. And when I bought my house there, I knew about field burning smoke, but I didn't have any clue about what a fine particulate was. I'd never heard of that. I was kind of like people who, I didn't smoke, but it's like people who smoke, and they had no idea that smoking in front of their kids were essentially smoking cigarettes. We didn't know that for the longest amount of time, the impact of secondhand smoke. Well, when I started learning about the impact of fine particulates, I was shocked because this practice was still legal. And my parents live out there where I live, and they're in their 70s. And my nephew lives next door, and he's 8, and my other neighbor has a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old. And I would call the Oregon Department of Agriculture and talk to them about this and, you know, talk about these 2,000 peer-reviewed studies from the American Lung Association. Again, I'm just a citizen. I'm not a scientist. And the response I would get is that the American Lung Association is a political organization. They would consistently dismiss my concerns. And then I asked them one time what was in the smoke. Because someone told me that there can be incomplete combustion of smoke and that the fine particulates can get entrained with pesticide molecules. And the ODA couldn't tell me what was in the smoke. And I don't actually think it's their fault. I don't think they've been funded. But I wanted to show you this because this just shows you the frustration of people like me. And by the way, there's 84,000 of us. There's 84,000, about 150 growers out of 1,400 still burn their fields. And they're impacting 84,000 of us who live within 5 miles of a burn. I don't know if you can see this very well. It was actually in the packet that Dan gave you. But these big kind of brown spots, those are air monitoring devices. And the little tiny yellow dots are all the field burns. And I live right about here. They burn at the bottom of my hill. There's no measuring device anywhere near where I live. In fact, 94% of the field burns happen 5 miles or further away from the measuring devices, which goes right to your point, Representative Thompson. And again, ODA, I once asked them, you know, are you taking care of us? Are you protecting us? And what they said to me is, my job, this is a quote, my job is to have the community angry at me and to have the farmers angry at me. And if I know they're both angry at me, I know I'm doing a good job. But that is just unbelievably frustrating if you're somebody who's got parents who are in their 70s who are breathing the fine particulates. And the one thing I want to say in closing, you can't just go into your house and close the windows and shut the doors. The smoke comes right through. I have left the area the last 2 summers because I'm sensitive to smoke. But my parents can't afford to leave, and my nephew and my brother, they can't afford to leave. So they're breathing all this. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions to this panel?
Just a brief comment. Holly, I would suggest you not move to Southern Oregon because the smoke there from forest fires is devastating and getting worse each and every year, and it lasts for months.
Well, I guess the reason that I'm here and the reason I was here 2 years ago is there's some things that we can take action on. Like when we learned about secondhand smoke, we took action to protect people who work in public places. And again, there's a small amount of the fields are still burned. It's not, you know, from where I'm standing, it's not a necessary practice. And that smoke that 84,000 people don't have to breathe, if we can get your help.
Thank you very much.
If I could just follow up on that, Representative Maurer, as well, briefly. we discussed the compounding impacts of the California fires in 2008 with the field burning. And, of course, the Department of Agriculture attempts to not allow field burning when there are other significant pollution in the air, but you will read in our report September 18th when there was significant intrusion of smoke from the California wildfires. Field burning was allowed on September 18th of last year nonetheless, and the compounding effect was to significantly hammer communities in and around Lyons with levels of particulate pollution that are of serious medical concern.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I call Roger Beyer, Zach Taylor, Eric Bowers, and Dave Nelson, please?
Mr. Chair. Do we have anyone from the Department of Agriculture here to testify?
No, because we're talking particularly about health effects tonight.
No, I understand that, but they're required to monitor and the combined effects, and so they are not environmental health. I was just wondering if they have any response to some of this.
They do not.
Okay.
Senator Beyer?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer here, representing the Oregon Seed Council. I am the executive secretary of that organization. You will soon be receiving a packet that I have just given for you to look at. I won't go into elements other than the health issues unless you ask me questions about them. In the packet, first of all, I would like to bring your attention to pages 2 and 3. Those are the National Ambient Air Quality Standards adopted by EPA for all regions. These are standards, and they have been adopted to protect the health of vulnerable populations. You will see under fine particulate matter, the PM 2.5, about halfway down the page, the levels there that are the standard. Field burning smoke does not and has not caused any of these monitoring stations to exceed those standards. Next, on page 4 and 5 of the packet, you will see a chart that talks about the air quality data summaries from 1998 through 2007. I have only included the Willamette Valley monitoring stations in this. And about halfway down page 4, about two-thirds of the way down 4, you will see in Lebanon monitoring station, and for your information, those that are bolded are for the last 2 years, just so you don't have to look at the entire document. But if you look about halfway down this page in Lebanon, that is the only one that has the maximum daily number being in the field burning season. And I would like to point out the reason that one is in the field burning season is because they only monitor in that area during field burning season. That station is not monitored during the winter months or the spring months, only during the summer months. So if you look at the rest of these standards, Willamette Valley, the number one dates are always in the wintertime, never during field burning season. Next, you will see the charts of the quality air monitoring stations that Representative Thompson has already alluded to. I have included in the packet the field burning report for 2008 also. And again, you will see that impacts were very limited in 2008. In 2008, the smoke impacts recorded were a total of 10 days, and that was a total of 5 hours of moderate or more. We never exceeded moderate. And you will see the listing of light. Those impacts are not required to be monitored by the Department of Ag, but we monitor them because we know they are impacts. But you will see the impacts of smoke there. It was extremely light in the 2008 season. I also have included on page 24 an asthma data study for hospitalizations of asthma. And you will see, as you saw 2 years ago, and as you'll see every year, that the hospitalization for asthma is in the lowest of the year during field burning season. We heard Gail Shibley say that hospitalization is not a good measure of the health effects. I guess I would ask her, what is, if it's not hospitalization? You also see right below that the chart of acres burned by months. Again, those months correspond with the lowest instances of asthma attacks or hospitalizations. Also included is a health effects study done in Washington. I'd like to point out page 27 in the document. Right behind page 27, you will see an attached editorial from the Oregonian of about 10 days ago, and where they list the town of Lebanon at the hospital, mom's room just reeked of acrid field smoke. It's hazardous to anyone's health, but especially to the sick and the frail. This letter is a letter from the Lebanon hospital, and it states very clearly they have never had an instance of smoke in their rooms in the Lebanon hospital. What we are looking at is that people like the Oregonian have not moved beyond 1988. They are talking about 20-year-old or older data about field burning. The industry has significantly changed since 1988. The burning has been greatly reduced. The scientific use of the forecasting is greatly enhanced. We have done everything possible to minimize the smoke impacts of that practice. Finally, in the times I have left, I'd like to point you to page 28. A question was asked about the alternatives to field burning and what they would do or what the potential trade-offs are. If you look at that graph, that is a graph of the makeup of fine particulate in diesel exhaust. Diesel exhaust will be one of the two major trade-offs of field burning if you ban the practice. The other major trade-off is dust, agricultural dust. Fugitive dust makes up approximately 85% of the pollution in Willamette Valley in the summertime, and agricultural dust is one of the components, one of the major components of fugitive dust. The other, another impact trade-off is diesel emissions and diesel exhaust. If you look at that chart, on the far right-hand corner of that chart, you see PM 2.5 on the upper side of it. Everything to the left of that in diesel exhaust is PM 2.5 or smaller. To the right of that is PM 2.5 to PM 10. If you look at the abstract, you will see that the chronic long-term effects to diesel exhaust are very great. This is a study that was done, that was put out by the EPA. It's a health assessment document for diesel engine exhaust. There are more than a dozen studies, medical studies listed in that document that talk about the chronic long-term exposure to diesel exhaust and the health effects of that. My calculations are, according to that document, there are approximately 9 grams per gallon of diesel burned of PM 2.5 in diesel exhaust. That would be 9 million micrograms. If you figure about an extra 650,000 gallons of diesel exhaust being burned, or diesel being burned in, as a, the alternative to field burning, that would get you about 6.5 times 10 to the 11th micrograms of diesel exhaust.
Well, if somebody's calculating that, would you wrap it up? I've given you twice the time.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would point out that to say that banning field burning would be beneficial would be the equivalent to saying you should probably close I-5 and ban people from I-5 on duck football home games, because if just you're not monitoring next to that either, and the PM particulate level on that is probably more significant than the exposure to the people along the freeway than the exposure from field burning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is that suggesting you have an amendment to this to reduce the amount of diesel exposure?
You mean by banning home football games?
No, not that. I know that won't sell. Mr. Taylor?
Yeah. Yeah, hi, I'm Zach Taylor. I'm a fourth-generation grass seed farmer from the Silverton Sublimity area. And married, one child, have many relatives and friends in the area, and I would never do anything to risk their health by burning or any other agricultural practice. You can look in the room behind me and outside. There's several hundred, if not thousand, years of burning under everybody's belt, and I think everybody looks fairly healthy around here. I have hay fever myself. The smoke doesn't bother me. When you look at how we burn our fields, if anyone was to be affected by the smoke, when Andy was talking about, you know, the exposure and the duration, if anybody was to be affected by it, it would be us, the farmers. If we light a field, say with a west wind, we light the east side first as a backfire, and we patrol the east side of the fire for probably a half an hour, and we're back in the smoke, just eating it, making sure that, because we burn up along timber and we don't want the fire to get out,
And so we're back in there eating smoke, trying to make sure that everything's safe.
So I think of wearing a respirator wouldn't hurt.
If we have time, you know, the ODA doesn't give us a lot of time. We do the best we can to work, but at times you got to go burn. So anyway, I've never drove out of the smoke and just thought, oh, you cough a little bit, but you never. It's not like I've never felt like I'm sick or I'm going to die from this. I think it's important to talk about where we farm and where we burn. And for us, it's in the Silverton Sublimity Hills. Non-irrigated, not a lot of crop options. Fine fescue is the crop that we burn. And we're allowed to keep this crop in for 6+ years without having to till the fields. This crop also uses less pesticides, less fertilizer, less tillage. It's just a win-win all the way around. And inevitably, air and water quality factor into the health of our people. And if we can't burn, inevitably we're going to have to use more pesticides, more fertilizers, till more, and there'll be more erosion and worse water quality. So not only is burning necessary for seed yield, but it's a great organic or natural sanitation of fields. Representative Holvey was kind enough to come up and visit our farm last summer, and we asked him, what happens, what are we going to do if we can't burn our fields? We explained about the environment stuff, and he says, well, can't you use more chemicals? Well, that seems a little counterproductive. But, let's think about it. Something natural, field burning.
Can you wrap it up, please?
More chemicals. Yep. So the asthma thing we kind of touched on, the low rates in the summertime and the high rates in the wintertime. So in closing, I'd just like to say that thermal sanitation is one of the most natural and environmentally friendly things we can do. And in this nonpartisan climate that we've heard so much about lately, I would hope that the government and us farmers can work in harmony, and let's not let the loud minority make decisions for how the quiet majority feels.
Or even the loud majority. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eric Bowers from Harrisburg, Oregon. I'm a fourth-generation grass seed farmer. I've been working for myself or my family on our farm for 34 years. One of my first jobs as a kid was I would ride around on the tailgate of my grandpa's pickup and light the fields on fire. That was one of my first jobs. We're here to talk about the health effects of field burning. I have asthma. I've had asthma ever since I was a little boy. In the years I've burnt fields, I've never had an asthma attack from field burning. I went to school with kids that had asthma, and not one of them had problems from field burning. In the world of science, a 5 or 10 year study is considered a pretty thorough study. Field burning has been happening for 55 to 60 years. Most of the farmers here today have been in and around it almost all of their lives, and every one of us is pretty healthy and don't have any health effects from field burning. Over the years, I've worked with 180 to 200 different employees of varying age and gender. I've seen plenty of them with hay fever, but never have a problem with smoke. My grandma is 93 years old, has been around field burning smoke for 2/3 of her life. Grandma mowed her own lawn with a walk-behind mower until she was 90 years old, and finally we made her quit, and she sits in the house while my brother mows her lawn. But she has no breathing problems either. She's got some aches and pains, but I don't think they were caused from field burning, unless she got bounced off the tailgate. Our field produces oxygen for 9 months out of the year. And for the little bit of smoke that we put up for a few days in the summer, it seems to me that our positives far outweigh our perceived negatives. This is a right to farm issue and not a health concern. I urge you to vote no on this issue and table it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Nelson. I've been the Executive Secretary of the Oregon Seed Council from 1975 through 2007. So I've seen this is not a new issue. It's an issue that has been around for a long time. During that period of time, a number of things have happened. Field burning has been reduced from a high of 320,000 acres a year in 1972 to something like 30,000 acres last year. And I would challenge you to find another industry who has reduced their emissions by 90% over some similar period of time. As you know, on any given entity or any given activity, maybe the first 90% are the easy ones and the last 10% are the hard ones, and there are reasons for that that get into the various things. The DEQ, Andy said, or somebody said, maybe it was Representative Holby, said that field burning is about 2% of the particulate in the airshed of the Willamette Valley. That 2%, I want you to keep in mind, is the same 2% that they were using when we were burning 250,000 acres back in the 1980s. So I would suggest the recalculation of the amount of particulate that's actually contributed to the Willamette airshed from field burning. I think it should be some factor less than 2%, just simply because the mass reduction in acreage burned that has taken place. Former Representative Shibley commented that on the asthma study, it's been a year or so since I read the asthma study, but I also point out to you that the highest incidences of asthma, as I recall reading that study, were in places like Coos Bay and Wheeler County. And certainly there's no grass seed production in those areas. And while we're slightly above the average being somewhere around 11%, and in Linn County and Lane County being 11.2% or 11.5%, something on that order. So, you know, go back to Mark Twain, there's statistics, there's dam statistics, and there's whatever else that was. pesticide use is higher.
I think it was. There's liars or dam liars and there's statisticians.
Okay, got it. I think you go back, and I want to just hold up Senator Byers' table. This is a table of impact. And in health effects, you have source and you have impact. And that's why you have ambient air quality standards. You're measuring ambient air quality. You're not measuring emissions at the source. You're measuring ambient air quality. Mr. Galpern said on September 18th, Lyons got hammered. Lyons had 4 hours of smoke. That's the only 4 hours of smoke impact that was recorded in the moderate category. Moderate is less than 12 miles visibility, but greater than 5 miles visibility. I think that if you and I looked outside and thought we could see somewhere between 5 and 12 miles, that we weren't being hammered. So I think that there's been a lot of exaggeration on the effects of field burning smoke through the years. We know we are down to 10% remaining. There are areas, as Zach Taylor said, that are very difficult. They were highly eroded back in the 20s and 30s. Grass seed is the best crop that is there, and it's in the best for the health of the farmers that are there. And I also would say that if you look at this, that field burning is the only industry in the state where the regulatory agencies have gone out and put monitors in the pathway. They've not put monitors in any other pathway, but they put monitors in the pathway of the emissions from field burning smoke, and the records are clear that it's not much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panel? We have, incidentally, two Department of Agriculture's representatives here, Representative Kotek, to answer your questions, if there are any other.
Could I answer his question that he asked one of the other people about the pesticides?
Go for it. Briefly, though.
Yes, we will use more pesticides. I know that for a fact because on the fields that I quit burning, I used, on a fescue field, for instance, we always spray a fescue field after we burn it one time. This is tall fescue I'm talking about. We sprayed it one time. Now, since we do not burn tall fescue anymore, we spray it three times. Once in September, once in October, and one again in November, and we don't get near the weed control that we would get with the field fire. On annual ryegrass, the other crop that I burn, that I still burn, I don't burn tall fescue anymore, but when we don't burn annual ryegrass, we have to plow it, and it's going to take a pesticide every year, where if we burn it, we might put a pesticide on it once every 4 or 5 years. So it is quite an increase in pesticides and diesel smoke, like Roger was saying.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Given your time, can I follow up with that? Or
sure.
I'm very sensitive to time.
No, go ahead.
My only question to you is what, and if this is veering too far into agriculture rather than health, I'll appreciate that, Mr. Chair. How do you make the determination, though? I mean, in your particular situation, how do you make the decision? You say you've taken some off out of the burn scenario. Why?
I mean,
there's got to be a cost benefit there.
And in my situation, I farm a lot of wet soils, and so I can't make the straw rot. It doesn't have any oxygen. It's either if I leave the straw on top of the ground to volunteer the crop, which means leave the seeds that came out of the back of the combine to make the crop, it creates a spongy, slimy mess, and it will not rot. And the ryegrass doesn't look good all year, and it doesn't do very good the next summer. If I plow it under, I've got the cost of plowing it under. Now, on my better soils, where I grow some tall fescue and some of my annual ryegrass is on my better soils, I'll leave the full straw load out there on some of the fields and let it decompose naturally. I do have some problems with slugs and voles when I do that situation, but yet we are using those situations. When this 10% business of the farmers, where the 10% of us that are burning, or people that are burning 10%, we're not burning our whole farm. We're burning parts of our farm where we need the fire because that is the best tool for the job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Can I have, who do we have? Lisa Hansen and John Beyer, please, from Oregon Department of Agriculture and Representative Kotick. Have at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
thank you for volunteering to let us know when you were here today.
Thank you. And you might not be able to answer these questions right now because you might not have seen this report, but I'm curious to hear your responses to the report presented by the Western Environmental Law Center, particularly their summary about the fact that the Department of Agriculture undercounts burn days in a season by ignoring days during which fewer than 300 total acres are burned. And just wonder, there seems to be their feeling from this report that the monitoring is poor, that when, particularly the case in September when we had smoke coming up from the south, that burning was allowed, it increases the risk. What are you required to do, and why 300 acres is somehow a magical number that wouldn't also have health effects?
So for the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is John Byers, our program manager for the smoke management program. And it was our understanding that this was going to be a hearing on health effects, and so we did not come prepared to address any of that. But I have provided you with a packet of information from the department that talks about the program and also has a full copy of our annual field burning report from 2008. And with that, I think I'll go ahead and let John address some of your questions about the burning last spring.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives, the 300-acre, let me start with that particular. I'm sorry?
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. John Byers, Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'm the program manager of the smoke management program. The 300 acres is a situation of strictly how we organize field burns. Typically, with 300 acres or less, that's what we call preparatory burning. For example, if you had a barn underneath or in the middle of a field, you would want to burn around that barn before you ignited the whole field. So what we allow the growers to do, we issue permits at 5 acres at a pop, so you can do that preparatory burning. That goes up to a maximum of 300 acres. They are separated greatly by time that those permits are issued and location of where those fields are burned. So we do still track them as far as impacts. We still do count them as cumulative totals when we report numbers of acres burned on an annual seasonal basis.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yes, please.
But the 300 acres is more of a, there's no public health component there, is what I'm trying to get at is I would assume that you will have risk to health, regardless, obviously maybe not at 5 acres, but at 250 acres, still a lot of smoke. Maybe not counted the same way, not tracked the same way, impact on the folks who are living around. Because one of the things from their report is the location of the field burning, location of where folks live, the fact that we don't monitor necessarily where people live and where the burns are. I just worry that, I know your job is not necessarily
all about air quality, but having some arbitrary, the 300 doesn't seem to be based on whether or not that affects anyone's health. That's just as how you arrange how you do your permitting.
Yes, ma'am, I understand that. Part of the issue is that it is all meteorologically based. Before we issue any permit, be it for a small burn or a large burn, we still look at the meteorological aspects of where that smoke may go. We take into account things like mixing height, essentially how high the smoke is going to go, temperature, relative humidity, wind speed and direction. So even though it's a 5-acre field or a 450-acre field, the meteorological aspects of where that smoke is likely to go will be monitored, and before that permit is issued, we will take that into consideration. As far as the locations of the nephelometers, I heard from the report that they were talking about less than 5 miles from where the field burns. That's, in many cases, as Andy Ginsberg had indicated, is by design. For example, we probably will hit places like Sweet Home in a more... probably more often than other locations, because that's where it's at a higher elevation. The smoke goes to 6,000 feet on a good burn day. We are pluming that smoke. We're burning on a mixing height that's essentially 5,000 feet or greater. And so the intent is to get the smoke up and over the Cascades. And unfortunately, very often, if we're going to hit a location, it would be in Sweet Home. So that is why we have a nephelometer at that particular location. Having a nephelometer at the base of the field would really not provide much specific information for you, because the smoke is going to go up and over that particular location. At least that's the intent of the meteorology.
All I would say to that is weather changes, and I'm not a meteorologist, but I looked at one of the charts that Representative Holvey provided about, this is August 8, 2007, compared to the day before impact of fine particulates in the Sweet Home area. Pretty alarming. I know that the National Ambient Air Quality Standards talk about, 3-year average on 24-hour period, but if I'm a person living in Sweet Home, and this is the burn that's happening on this day in August, and I'm vulnerable to a heart attack or some other respiratory illness, it's pretty concerning. And I know that's not necessarily your job, but, I just think our system is not protecting folks to the fullest extent.
It is our concern as well. The goal of the program is to provide the growers an opportunity to burn while protecting the public as best as we can, and we try very hard to do that. There are instances where we do impact the general public, and we recognize that, and the growers recognize that as well.
Thank you for your answer. I appreciate it.
Yes, Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. Nephelometer, is that the name of the monitor?
Nephelometer, yes.
Nephel. Well, okay. I guess one of the arguments earlier was that you have these in the wrong places to pick up field smoke. And I think you were addressing that in part now, but I just wanted to clarify that and get a better feel for their location and whether they're accurate in monitoring levels of smoke that are penetrating into the communities and analyzing. And I guess they also analyze the particulate levels.
I think the easiest way to describe that is we call them sniffers, and it does measure particulate measure. That's correct. We do have them throughout the valley. They are operated by DEQ, and through our memorandum of understanding, we provide that information that they monitor. What we try to do is... one of the things that was mentioned earlier that I'd like to point out, in other states, if you would like to burn a grass seed field, they will tell you today if you can burn it tomorrow. One of our situations is that we will tell the growers they have 1 hour in which to light the field, because the meteorology at that particular point in time is deemed to be successful and get the smoke away from the general public. In the summertime, we have primarily westerly winds. We burn fields primarily on westerly winds. So those nephelometers are placed in locations where the smoke is likely to go. If you were to look over time, the nephelometers in places like Karis, which is up near Oregon City, in Salem or in Portland, you're not going to find many impacts, because simply that's not where we are directing the smoke. Is there opportunity for other nephelometers? Is that possible we could place them in other locations? Absolutely. It is possible to do.
Back to my question, are you capturing fairly accurately
the amount of the smoke that is being generated and measuring its impact on the communities by the locations that currently exist.
Actually, I don't think that was the issue before. I mean, I think the issue was that asthma is caused by a lot of things, and this is only a question of marginal addition, and the air quality monitors aren't out there. Usually, most of them are not out there, the ones that Representative Thompson was talking about, to look at the smoke effect. They're out there to look at the air quality effect, generally speaking.
But they can't.
So the question is, they've got special monitors that look for the smoke, but I think the monitors that were in the reports that Representative Thompson was looking at are monitoring other kinds of air pollution. I think that was the issue here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may follow up just briefly, I think one of the challenges that we face in this discussion, one of the major goals of the smoke management program is to keep the smoke out of the very populated areas. And unfortunately, with that sometimes has the smoke ends up in some of the less populated areas. I think in terms of the locations of the nephelometers, they are likely more populated in those areas in which we are trying to keep the smoke out of, generally. Is that fair, John?
I think that's fair.
In terms of a simple description?
Yes, and again, because we burn primarily on westerly winds in the summertime, and we know that, we don't have nephelometers on the west side of the valley because we are not likely to put smoke there.
I hope that was helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of your goals is to use meteorological criteria to plume at a certain height and under certain westerly wind conditions and to get smoke out of the densely populated areas. Yet we see data from certain particular dates where there are obviously marked differences. What I'm wondering is, are these dates exceptions to successes? Are you, under successful conditions, able to deliver the plumes to areas where they're not going to cause as much trouble? And some of what we're seeing is results from notable exceptions to these practices.
Yes, sir, absolutely. For illustration, I will give you, we are not allowed to burn on weekends, which isn't exactly true. There are certain instances where we can burn on weekends. There was a Saturday that we burned several years ago when we burned over 10,000 acres and didn't receive a single call and didn't receive a single impact. That was a victory, and that is more of the norm on the large burn days, and that was primarily because of meteorology. We had perfect burning conditions.
Sweet Home east of the burn?
Sweet Home is east of the burning, yes, sir.
Sweet Home is going to get, if you've done it successfully, Sweet Home is going to get the plume. Now the question is if you can get it high enough.
Right. Correct. Up and over is the goal. Right.
But it is in the path of where the plume is going.
That is correct. So to answer your question, yes, impacts are not the norm. Success is generally more common than not.
51%? 80%?
Roughly. I'm trying to sort this out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hammering Sweet Home might be a success in terms of keeping it out of Eugene.
That is certainly a strategy.
Yes. And the assumption that Eugene is more populous, where you're trying to keep the smoke away from, putting it over a less populated area is to a certain extent a success. The people in Sweet Home may not agree with that. But.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Harker, in the back of your packet, there's a 2008 smoke management report. And on page 11 and 12, to give you an idea without doing percentages, figure 10 shows the 2008 open field burning impacts of the days where we had impacts that were recorded by the nephelometers. And so that gives you an idea of the number of hours during those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, I believe 12 days where we had impacts. And 2008 was actually quite a good year for us in terms of being able to get smoke up and out of the valley. For the how many acres did we burn?
Approximately 40,000.
Okay.
Okay. So hopefully that gets you to
move on.
I know. Thank you.
And they'll be discussing this, I suspect, at another committee meeting of another committee before we're done. Thank you very much for
Do a quick,
very quick.
Okay. Well, it'll hold.
Okay.
Thank you.
We are going to close at 5, and we're going to leave many people disappointed as it is. Can I have Carla Herbert, Steve Rodwell, Carolyn Higgins, and Stephen Jorgensen, please? Stephanie Jorgensen. We're not going to get to the ones we have. So. Following that, we're going to have Charlie Tibbett, Anne Marie somebody that I can't read, and David Quillen, and Troy Hadley. Maybe all that many. Depending on how fast you guys go. Go for it.
Hi, my name is Carla Herbert, and I'm from Eugene. And I'm a registered nurse and an exercise physiologist, and I understand on a professional and a personal level how field burning and fine particulate matter affect healthy people and those with heart and lung disease. I work passionately as a rehabilitation therapist to help improve quality of life for our pulmonary and cardiac patients, who, by the way, live in Eugene and Springfield. So with all this talk of, you know, sacrifice zones and who's getting hit, I work in Eugene. My folks live in Eugene and Springfield. Lung disease, heart disease, and they're hit very, very strongly. I'll go over that. But it's just kind of interesting to hear the conversations. But my folks don't live in Staten and don't live, you know, in some of these areas here. So they do get affected. So we try to improve the quality of life for these cardiac and pulmonary patients through an extensive education and exercise program. And there's been a lot of talks about hospitalizations, which is interesting to me, you know, trying to look at, is there a direct cause and effect from field burning smoke, and is it putting people into the hospital? There's been a lot of talk about that, and I couldn't help but say that there is really clear-cut data that shows air pollution, increase in fine particulates, do increase hospitalizations. I have the journals, the medical journals here with me. So there are... there is that data. But it's not just hospitalizations that I want to talk about. It's increased costs of medications. Patients have to spend several hundred dollars on medications. It's doctor visits. It's emergency room visits. So there's a lot of costs there, and health costs, and quality of life, too. So we have to, you know, think about all that, not just hospitalizations. So I do see firsthand how our patients suffer during field burning. They miss their sessions with us. They have to stay home. They're afraid to go outdoors. They come in more short of breath. They're using more oxygen. They're having to use more inhalers. I have one patient who uses up to 7 inhalers for when she gets in trouble. And she's actually been hospitalized 3 times after being after an incursion from field burning. She has been admitted to the hospital and been in the hospital 3 or 4 days after a field burning session that she got exposed to. So I've seen that happen. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about some of these nasty, nasty side effects from these medicines that these folks with heart and lung disease, primarily lung disease, have to use to keep them from going to the hospital. Steroid medications, inhalers, they're often used as a rescue medicine when people, asthmatics, people with emphysema, have trouble breathing. But the steroids, the steroid use comes with a really high price, and there are really detrimental effects from steroids. I just wanted to mention that it's not just hospitalizations, it's emergency room visits, doctor calls, a lot of health risks and costs to these patients. And I see it every day in my work. That's fine. Thank you for letting me speak.
Next, please.
Hi. Thanks for letting me speak today. My name is Steve Rodwall, and for those of you that might not be familiar with the name, I stood here about 20 years ago with the initial field burning deal because my family was involved in the field burning accident or wreck on I-5 on August 3rd. And I thought things had been resolved, sort of. But I knew they were still burning. But I always thought, okay, the government's going to take care of it. Until last September, when I was coming back from my son's soccer game in Cottage Grove, and I was a little bit north of Eugene when I entered an area that smoke was passing over I-5 quite heavily. Not enough to block your vision. I mean, I could look to the west and see the field burning going on. I could see the flames that were burning on that side. And the east side, it just took me back to what my brother must have encountered, except in a much worse scenario. And I think enough time has gone by. I think something needs to be done to control this to a much greater extent than it is going on now. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Stephanie Jorgensen. This is my house. It's in Staten, Oregon, and it is right in the center of the train tracks, and there's a freight train hitting my house for 4 months in the summer, and I have small children. I wrote a statement so I don't get too emotional. I'm here to testify and tell you who I am and what we need. My name is Stephanie Jorgensen. I'm a stay-at-home mom. I have two beautiful children. You can hear them in the back, Kellen and Lainey. I volunteer weekly at my son's preschool. I volunteer at the community library to help young children in our community. My husband's a family physician, and he was compelled to start a medical practice in a rural community. 17 months ago, we relocated our family to Staten. I didn't think I'd get upset. I'm here because we've suffered through an entire burn season, and we don't want our children's tiny developing lungs to be exposed to another day of burning. The first time we experienced a burn day, we were mortified that the beautiful state of Oregon would pollute the very air we breathe. We ran around ushering the kids inside, shutting the windows. We turned on the local radio station because surely something must have gone wrong. But there was no news story. It was just an ordinary burn day. From our backyard, inside state and city limits, you can see the billows of black and gray smoke climb the sky. You can see the haze cover the blue sky and float into our neighborhood. Despite closing all of the windows, smoke still enters our house. Pieces of debris fall in our yard. Ash coats our cars and my children's outdoor toys. We know that field burning will harm our children. We have confined them inside on 11 burn days last season. It would have been more if we weren't able to travel out of town. Days after a burn, I don't know when the pollutants are out of the air. Do I let my kids play in the backyard the following morning or the morning after that? When is it safe? I am also concerned for all of the kids that I do see that play outside on burn days. It is obvious to me that some parents in our community are unaware that field burning can harm their children and create a lifetime of respiratory problems for them. We need an immediate ban on field burning. Please help the people in our community who count on you to make the decisions that can keep them safe. Please do not expose our beautiful children to another day of burning. I need your help to support House Bill 2183 and implement a ban immediately. Please don't make us suffer another burn season. Thank you for your work, and thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for coming.
Sorry, I got emotional.
You did fine. Thank you.
That's a hard act to follow. My name is Carolyn Higgins, and I live in one of the areas where when they burn, they want it to come to my house. And what she has said, I could say too, because when it burns, the big thing about a burn is if I knew every day of the week or even the month, if they told me these are the days you're going to burn, I could get ready for it. But from the 5th of July, until the 15th of November, I never know. Never. And like they said, I can have all things going in the morning, and all of a sudden at 2 o'clock, there it is. Or it can be in, mostly it's in the afternoon, but we never know. We never know. And you know in Oregon when it rains, and you might want to do something, but you don't know? Do you know what that feels like? Well, it feels a lot worse when it's field burning, and what she said, it comes into your house. It's on everything. The big ashes. But that's not the point. It's in my body. I'm a walker on my mountain. And you know, a few years ago, they say ignorance is bliss. Well, it is. Because about 4 or 5 years ago, I would walk on my hill any time I wanted. But now that I know about field burning and the danger it is to our health, I don't do that anymore. So the question I want to ask you people, and I really want you to hear this, is do you think that field burning is dangerous to our health? Do you absolutely believe that it's dangerous to our health? Nothing else matters. Nothing else that we've said matters. Except if you believe that it's hurting Oregonians, then you have got to stop it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony. Okay. Charlie Tibbetts. Anne Marie. We'll find out what that last name is. What?
Pierre.
P-I-R, huh? Oh, I could read it. I just didn't believe it. Thank you. And David Quillen. And we'll try Troy Hadley as well. See if we can get through that. And for others of you, I hope your point of view has been expressed well. There'll be more hearings in other committees, and I think we've done the best we can in the time we have. Who starts? Mr. Tibbetts?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Charlie Tibbetts.
Go for it.
A number of points to raise. First, about the national ambient air quality standards that were discussed earlier. That standard is set on a practical level by EPA. If the medical literature were to set that standard, it would set it at zero because it recognizes that particulates at any level cause health problems. But as a practical matter, if you set it at zero, the whole country would be in violation of the Clean Air Act. But the medical literature shows on a linear relationship, as particulates go up, health problems go up on a linear relationship, starting at zero. Second point, the Lebanon smoke was years ago. It wasn't years ago. It was just last summer. And Mr. Bauer, who's quoted extensively in the Oregonian, talks about that his particular experience. He grew up in that seed country. He's not making things up, as was implied by the seed industry. Third issue, agricultural dust. Agricultural dust is a large particulate. Our bodies have defense mechanisms to deal with that. They don't have defense mechanisms to deal with the PM2.5. Fourth point, there's only 150 people that are left burning in this state, and they're influencing 84,000 people that live in the rural areas and perhaps hundreds of thousands of people that are living in the cities. As a matter of public policy, it's time to put this practice to an end. Seven, the Lyons discussion that was discussed earlier, the specific number on that day I don't have, but Representative Thompson discussed this earlier. If there were only 6 or 8 burn days, and there were actually, I think, 11 where more than 1,000 acres were burned in 2008, the percentage, Representative Harker, is close to 100% of exceptions that you asked John Byers about. Because here are the charts that show, this is just in Lyons, and it's in our report as well, that the spikes go up. There's 6 spikes in Lyons. And if there were only 8 burn days, as Representative Thompson mentioned, which there are actually just a few more, it would have been 100%, but it's actually more like 70%. Smoke that's intended to go to other places, for instance, the Coast Range, and I have this personal experience myself. I live south of Fern Ridge Reservoir near Veneta. You could see it go there one day, and it was going there all day because you saw the huge mushroom clouds heading that way. But then when the wind switched later that afternoon and the evening, they come all the way back and hit the other areas. So it not only hits them once, but it hits them twice in the same day. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Peer.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Anne Marie Peer, and I'm a farmer in Marion County, particularly in South Salem. I support the House Bill 2183, and I hope that you approve it as well for the following reasons. First, I have asthma and I have a heart condition. Every summer, my health deteriorates as a result of the air pollution from field burning. There are many people like me, and they have given up hope over this issue, and they don't even bother to complain or show up at these meetings. Some have died due to their respiratory illnesses, and others are in queue waiting. Second, the era of global warming, the ignoring of global warming, and the failed policies of the Bushes are over. The reputation of the United States around the world over this issue is very low. The global warming is real, and we are all in it together, and together we must correct the mess. Don't look at the skies right now. Look at the valley around July and August. The mushroom clouds of air pollution from the field burnings are lined up one after the other, and they cover the whole Willamette Valley. And third, it is not true that the farmers will lose their profit if they don't burn their grass fields. I have 130 acres next to my home. In fact, they publish revenues of the farmers who used to burn their field, the grass fields in the state of Washington has increased compared to when they practiced field burning in the past. There is a Stephen Van Muverick, who is on the board of the directors of the Department of Agriculture, and on his website, he says that he was growing up in a dairy business, and his current position as Oregon division manager for the Anderson, Hay, and Grain Company. Steve Van Murick brings a wealth of experience and insight into many key issues facing the Oregon agricultural today. And the Anderson, Hay, and Grain Company reports that they export about $100 million worth of hay and straw each year from Oregon and Washington to dairy and beef farmers in Asia. And the company is the number one harvester, processor, and exporter in the global forage market. Van Muverick has been a key leader with the Oregon Ag Fiber Association, which, among other things, has worked hard to develop a market for grass straw residues that used to be handled by field burning. So there are things that they can do and profit.
Thank you very much. Next, please.
Hi, I'm Nikki Schumacher. I live in between Staten and Lyons up in the hills. I am married to a farmer. We have three children, 6, 3, and 3 months. And our oldest daughter, she is 6. She was diagnosed with asthma. She has never once had an asthmatic problem during field burning season, and she watches Daddy burn every year. So we're right in it. She helps flag. It's fine. The only time she uses her nebulizer treatments is in the winter time, when there's more smoke, I assume, from wood stoves. I'm an educated mom. I study child vaccinations. I nurse. I do all the right things for my children, and I would never put them in harm's way.
On cue. Yeah, too many people, mom.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank
and
you.
No. Thank you. Let's see. Do we have Troy Hadley?
Very quick question, Mr.
Yeah.
What did you mention about vaccinations?
I study them, all the rights and wrongs. Should I, shouldn't I? You hear the autism. I've read several books. I just feel like I'm an educated mom. I take motherhood very seriously, and I just would not do anything to my children to harm them, mm-hmm. including maybe vaccinating them, should that be an issue. But I'm not going to get into that here.
But what?
I won't get into that here.
Thanks.
Okay. Good. Do I have... David Quillen, yet?
That's me,
yes,
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, and then you'll be the last one. Good. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Quillen. I live in Staten. I've lived there since 2005. The summer before that, we were house-sitting up in Gates, a little further up the canyon. I've heard a lot of statistics here today, but the reality is when they're burning around Staten, and we're surrounded by it, it seems like from about July into September. If you get caught outside, you're in for sore throat, eyes burning and running, your lungs, you can feel it down in there. Best thing you can do is to head for home and shut the door and turn on the air conditioning and hope it keeps it out, but the problem is it doesn't, of course. It's pretty bad if you get caught out in it up there. And some of the times when they're burning, the smoke dissipates and heads over the mountain to the east, and sometimes it doesn't. Not infrequently, there'll be the wind will come out of the north at 20 or 25 knots, and you think, well, they're not going to burn today, but you look over around Sublimity, there's a big farm over there, and sure enough, here they light it off, and it comes right through Staten. And it's no fun, I hear to tell you. So I'm here in support of this measure, so I hope you'll vote for it. It's time we end this. It's a barbaric practice, folks, and it's time we end it, in my opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Actually, we only have two left on the list. Let's get both of them up. That'd be Gretchen Gantz, is it? As well as Troy Hadley. I think Mr. Hadley's the last one signed up in opposition. Let's go.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll keep this short. Thanks for letting me, Mr. Chair, and committee members. My name is Troy Hadley. I farm up in the Silverton Hills, up towards Silver Falls State Park. My family has been farming the same ground for 138 years. 50 years ago, we burned because we had no other way getting the straw. And over time, we realized fine fescue is the best crop to raise up there. The reason why we burn the fine fescue is not to get rid of the straw, just to get rid of the straw. If we do not burn, our yields are cut in half. But we're talking about health here. The other issues that we do not have compared to fields that are not burned is the water erosion, which has been presented, and mice, which carry many different diseases that transmit to humans. I have 13 acres of ryegrass that we do not burn. I have treated the older field twice since harvest to control the mice. With the fields we do not burn, we haven't treated at all. And it's not just the fact we kill some of them, because the fire doesn't get them all, but it eliminates the cover that gives them protection from the predators that we have out in the fields. And the other pest is slugs. We don't have a slug problem out in the fields that we burn. Why, I can't tell you. And as Zach said earlier, we put on less fertilizer, 100 units of nitrogen versus about 200 to 250 pounds per year. And right now, there is no market for fine fescue. Fine fescue straw has a property to it that does not allow it to be used for the same markets as some of the other fescue, like tall fescue and ryegrass. And if burning was so bad, why is an organically approved method of controlling pests and insects? And another option that nobody has presented, if we stop burning, we roughly burned 40,000 acres. That adds up to 3,800 more trucks on the road per year that's going to haul that straw away. And one thing I believe, is in my personal opinion, that a lot of the problems with asthma, because I have asthma, and my lungs actually open up. I breathe better while we're burning, and after we're done burning, than I do before.
That's a therapy we haven't tested yet.
Exactly.
Right here for
right, it's true. My lungs open up. I breathe great while we're burning. And I think a lot of the complaints and asthma is site-induced. They see the smoke, so they have a problem. If you look at ODA's information, there's 134 complaints from Eugene. Zero impact hours. Lyons is in the past. We've all established that. They had 14 hours on 7 days. There's 17 hours of impacts recorded. There was 25 complaints from Lions. And as it was said before, we burned on 12 days. So people were saying it's a 4-month period. It's 12 days we burned on and no 8. And in conclusion, if it's healthier not to burn, that what about the economy? We have a $350 million seed industry. If we eliminate burning, which will, for the most part, will move fine fescue out of the valley, and that will force us to convert to other varieties, which will just decimate that $350 million industry. And again, it's organically approved method. If it's that bad, why does OMRI, which is a national approved inspectors, approve it? Thank you for allowing me to speak, and I encourage you to pass this on with a no pass if there's any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hadley. Now, you're all that stands between us and adjournment.
Oh, wow. How fast can I talk?
No pressure.
Are you seriously good for me to go?
Yeah.
Okay, great, thank you. I'm Gretchen Gantz. I'm here today. I represent my friend Kate Duhem-Rodewald, her two girls, Mia and Dale Rodewald, and her husband, Bill Rodewald, who could not be here. The last time I was here was in 1991 for the same purpose. For 20 years, I've been working to ban field burning in the state of Oregon. After the first 5 years of working to get a bill passed, I became discouraged about the lack of support and began to lose faith in the process of our government. You will be hearing from many medical professionals and listening to scientific facts of long-term effects of the practice of field burning and crop management. My story is of immediate devastation from field burning, and the effects have been long-term. In 1988, my friend Kate Rodewald came home from Germany to relocate back to Oregon, the state where her husband was born and raised. He called Oregon God's country. Bill and Kate were both going back for their master's degree at the University of Oregon. They were teachers and wanted to make changes to improve the quality of education for all children. We had plans for the summer. Our boys were 11 and 12. Her youngest daughter and my youngest daughter are the same age, 8 months, when she came home. On July 27th, we went to Salem Art Fair with the babies and her two-year-old daughter, Dale. We were on our way home to Perrydale and stopped at Frank's Market and Rick Earl to nurse the babies and enjoy a beautiful rising moon. The boys had gone with our husbands. Our husbands have been best friends since they were 9 years old. That was the last moment that I shared with Kate. The next day, they left in our van to go to Eugene to stay with our friends Ronnie to look for a house so they could settle before school started. At August 3rd, 1988, at 4 p.m., Bill was driving. Kate was in the passenger side, and the girls were buckled into their car seat. At 4:03, my friend Kate, her husband, and the two daughters were dead. There's a saying that all things happen for a reason. It's been 20 years since Kate's death, 20 years since she and her family were killed in the I-5 accident that killed seven when a wind shift blew smoke across the highway, blinding the drivers. It is a tragedy that these vital people are dead, particularly tragic because they were killed by a practice that still, to this day, casts a shroud over God's country every summer. Kate's dad, the renowned author William Morton, walked these halls tirelessly trying to get a bill passed to end field burning. He died this year. 20 years after their death, he died without seeing an end to this practice. You are honorable people. In the memory of my friends, I would like you to support this bill to ban and not let field burning take another life in any manner. Thank you for your time, and thank you for supporting this bill.
Thank you very much. We have a statement from the American Lung Association in support of the bill to be read into the record. their representative had to leave. I want to thank you all for coming. This is an important issue. It's highly emotional on both sides. Our job was to take testimony on the health side of it. There'll be more going on. In fact, there's a hearing, I think, in the Senate tomorrow on, is that right, on the same issue. So there are bills in the House and the Senate, and we're going to see what happens on where those bills go before we do anything here. The public hearing is closed, and the meeting is adjourned.